welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast created by three men who are sitting in the precise order to create a mysterious effect that is known only to us.
As Barry's house. It only exists when the three of us are here.
Exactly.
At least in this form.
Right.
It's exactly. Wherever we exist. It's not in anyone's particular place.
We do not exist.
Also because the Earth moves, so we're moving all the time.
I like to believe that I'm superpositioned across the globe and therefore everywhere at all times.
You only believe that the Earth moves if you're a globalist. Anyway.
The universe moves around us. We're just fixed.
Like a disc.
Yes,
it's flat.
But believe it or not, this is a book review podcast.
What?
We're going to launch a rocket.
Yes, I'm going to fire Barry out of a cannon so that he can see that the world is flat.
Yes, there'll be some sort of curvature, but that's just, you know,
it's
a trick.
Right, it's the...
it's fake physics.
Right, it's the barrel distortion of his eyes.
Yes. Eyes are very short barrels.
I'm willing to try it.
You're willing to try shooting Barry out of a cannon?
Yeah, exactly.
You know you're next, right?
Well, if you come back, then yeah.
No, you're next.
Damn it.
All right. Well, I'm glad we got that out of the way so we can talk about Raven Stratagem by Yoon Ha Lee, narrated by Emily Wu Zeller. Who chose this? Why, it was me.
Steven did.
Yes.
But why did you choose it?
Because it is a Hugo nominee or Hugo finalist, whatever the term is.
I think it's finalist.
Yes.
Hugo nominee is a heretical designation.
Yes, and that would undermine the perfection of our effects. This will all make sense. Don't worry. Yes,
we are a triarchate.
We are. Okay, so from the back of the book, Captain Kel'Charis is possessed by a long-dead traitor general. Together, they must face the rivalries of the Hexarchate and a potentially devastating invasion. When the Hexarchate's gifted young captain, Kel'Charis, summoned the ghost of the long-dead General Shuos Jadao to help her put down a rebellion, she didn't reckon on his breaking free of centuries of imprisonment and possessing her. Even worse, the enemy Hafen are invading, and Jadao takes over General Kel'Kurowev's fleet, which was tasked with stopping them. Only one of Kurowev's subordinates, Lieutenant Colonel Kel Brezen, seems to be able to resist the influence of the brilliant but psychotic Jadao. Jadao claims to be interested in defending the Hexarchate, but can Kurowev or Brezen trust him? For that matter, will the Hexarchate's masters wipe out the entire fleet to destroy the rogue general? Will we make up any more words that Steven can't say?
Hello, hi, and this is going to be fun to edit.
Can you still say the word the?
Chi, thi, tu.
This bodes well.
It's Tehei.
All right. So, what did people think of the book?
I liked it.
Excellent.
It got even better on the second read.
Yes, that really needed two reads, and I only got one. And it was a little while ago. Kevin?
I got 1.25. Overall, I enjoyed it. I think I kind of went with the flow more than in the first book.
Yeah, I think I remember having feeling much more traumatized from the first one. I think it was maybe just more familiarity with some of the universe and the terminology.
Yeah, I think what really bothered me in the first book was the whole calendrical mechanics, and part of it was in audio. I couldn't quite tell what word that was for a while. It's like, is that like a colander? Is it like a calendar? What?
They have a mysterious weapon system based on colanders.
It's like we filter pasta that magically makes things happen. So I think I kind of went with it more, but also I enjoyed the bits with Jadao and company. There were other characters that I kind of found tiresome and tedious after a while, and I think the little bits that were supposed to be fun and interesting and quirky about characters, like I like sweets, were just like I found mostly banal and irritating, but I still enjoyed it.
That's how you think about people in general.
What do you mean?
Hey, I happen to know you like cookies quite a bit, so I don't know what you're complaining about.
No, I like cookies. It felt...
See, that's the sort of charming fact that will endear us to our listeners.
Yes. Weird. People have opinions about stuff. So yeah, I felt if I just kind of decided the entire book was sort of a portrayal of a collectible card game, mechanics, then it kind of worked better for me in my head, or maybe like an RTS or something like that, some of the computer game.
I honestly think that you could really do a good collectible card game.
Oh, yeah.
Based on this, also based on this podcast.
Yeah, yeah. You could.
I mean, there's only three cards.
But the fact I play the monster card.
You know, a lot of stuff was named off of animals and flowers and things. You could, I could easily imagine very artistic and interesting collectible card game, you know, how the mechanics would work and stuff like that. So like part of the enjoyment was sort of imagining that kind of as a background process to what was happening with the calendrical effects and just other weird stuff going on. So, yeah.
All right. Okay. Well,
did you have an opinion?
No, I don't have any opinions. I'm just a person.
You're just a servitor, huh?
I'm just a servitor. So, yeah, I don't have as much to report because I like the first one a little bit more than the two of you, I seem to recall. I like this one as much. In some ways, not remembering the end of the first book quite so well helped me appreciate this one a little bit more because there were surprises that were revealed in the last book that I had forgotten about. And so it was just like, oh, this is neat.
Yeah, that happened to me too, because I couldn't quite remember the state of certain things at the end of the first book, which they did reveal at the end of the first book, but I had forgotten. So I think I enjoyed this book more than I would have if I had known, because there was a mystery going on throughout two thirds of the book that wouldn't have been a mystery, I don't think, otherwise, if I'd remember.
Right, exactly.
And now we have the meta question of, can we do spoilers for the first book in the first half of this podcast for the second book?
I'm going to say let's be cautious about that because, you know, not everybody reads along with us. And my wife, for example, is reading the second book without having read the first book and seems to be quite enjoying it.
Good.
Not that she listens to this podcast.
Of course not. I was kind of wondering. She's like, does she actually care what we think? I'm going to guess no.
Well, it's time for us to enter the Black Cradle and get our immortality treatments that will enable us to survive to our spoiler sections where we can give this a thorough mathematical analysis.
Ooh, who's going to be my revenant?
It's Barry.
That's kind of disappointing, to be honest.
For all concerned,
I choose someone more beautiful if I were you.
We shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 And welcome back to our discussion of Raven Stratagem. I guess one of the questions is, how can we classify this on what Barry was referring to as the Mohs scale of military science fiction or science fiction in general?
Or does the Mohs scale even apply to military science fiction, since it's typically just applied to sci-fi books?
Right, exactly.
Perhaps you can explain this.
Would you like a pamphlet?
Yes, I would like a pamphlet on the Mohs scale.
So the Mohs scale is something we abscond, the sci-fi community has absconded with from the metalworking.
Right, the sci-fi community, which loves the term sci-fi. That's why they love our show.
Sci-fi, sci-fi, sci-fi.
Exactly.
Yes. It's a scale that's applied to
metals, gems. I think, you know, yeah, just about anything. Talk about diamonds.
Yeah. How hard something is.
Yes. Yeah. How hard is it to scratch? And there's a scale. And so the science fiction community has decided to use this term and to determine how, you know, sciencey a science fiction book is.
Right. And so this one is sort of a strange case because it's very rigorous. I get the impression that it all does make sense if you like follow along its own particular weird physics.
Well, right. It fulfills what I want out of a fantasy book, which is internal consistency of its physics. Mm-hmm. Although they didn't explain enough for me to actually believe that any of this stuff could be in our universe.
Yes.
Which is why it must be a collectible card game.
I like Shauna McGuire's sort of classifications of, you know, high logic, high nonsense.
Yeah.
And this is definitely a high logic world.
Yes, it is.
I think the terminology is just very unique in this book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the use of the term calendrical, and which to me is, I just sort of transplant with the word time. So maybe, you know, there are time and space weapons, but
it's mathematical.
It is. It's algebraic.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, the idea of these weapons that have exotic effects, so long as people are sort of standing in a certain line and, you know, all believing the same thing and all, you know, who have the same calendar and have done certain things.
Yeah. In right. advance. I mean, you know, if there was some behind the scenes hand waving where they said, oh, as long as each ship is generating a certain kind of field and they're all in phase, then this will happen. That would be enough. But for
that's
me.
Just more nonsense yeah. words.
If
really.
If they added that one line to the entire book, that would be enough for me to go, okay, now it's all science.
So instead it's fantasy?
It's midichlorians.
Yeah. Yeah, see, now in that case, it's bad. We don't need no midichlorians.
It's a tachyon field. That's why it makes sense. We don't need
no force tetrions. Control.
They're tetrions.
not verderons.
Oh, verderons are tetrions, just at a very high rate of flux.
What about tachyons?
Good job.
Good recovery, Data. Good recovery. Just keep spouting nonsense until everybody goes along with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to make it into like a ludicrous like thing that you can kind of make fun of and say, oh, no, more tetrions or whatever. Like,
right. Yes. Well, for the first book, I just sort of assumed that it was somehow existing inside a virtual world. Not that they were like humans in the Matrix, but
like a computer game or right. a virtual. And right. that, and that's kind of what I not thought, but I kind of thought it makes more sense in that context.
But, you know, the more I go along with it, I don't really think that it really applies. I mean, you can use that to get yourself into the book, but right. it's just another universe where
that stuff happens.
Right. Where, you know, whether or not you wear a wristwatch might have geopolitical consequences.
Right.
I mean, it was kind of like the exotic effects that were in the book were sort of like codified belief systems that they could lay right. over people, right. right? You know, and you know, oh, you flip this switch and this one gets turned on and y'all are gonna do formation instinct.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. And formation instinct was something that was touched on in the last book, but I think got a lot more of a going over in this one.
Oh, yeah.
Which is formation instinct is military discipline isn't just strong among certain groups of people. It's actually you have no choice but obey a commanding officer.
Right. It's sort of right. enforced in some.
You get physically ill way. If you don't. Actually do what you're told to do.
Exactly.
And you really, really want to do it usually unless you're a horrible crash hog.
And so somebody could essentially take over a portion of the military just by coming in, proclaiming and having it be somewhat the truth that you're somebody of a much higher rank and wearing, you know, particular insignia on your collar.
And everyone's like, oh crap. Okay, salute that person now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like when, you know, some other manager wanders over to your group and starts telling you guys what to do.
Yes.
And you just do it.
Right, exactly.
And then your boss comes back and goes, what the hell are you doing?
Like, well, you know, this high ranked person said to do it. Like, also.
That's the janitor.
Yeah, but he had donuts.
Exactly.
Very high ranking then.
Had to be the CEO.
Yes. All right. So, my advice is just relax and let the book wash over you.
Right. I mean, I think that's what I was saying is I kind of enjoyed it more than the first one because I just went with it more and just said, well, I'll think of it in this context, but you know, like you think of everything in a VR context, you know, it's like, okay, if it's a game or something, then I'll just pretend it's more enjoyable that way. And
Kevin, I'm not supposed to talk that much about the fact that I believe that this to be a virtual reality or else they might turn it off. Well, wait a minute. What am I talking about? Virtual reality.
It is a very dense book. And you know, I think having read the first one kind of gives you a bit of grounding in the universe, but even going through this one a second time, like I said earlier, it helped quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually able to process more of the subtleties of the book.
Right. Now, the first book actually had a lot more content internally about games, I think, whereas in this one, I mean, because like at one point, Jidao had Cheris.
Yeah, he does use like the Deuce of Gears as his
right.
symbol, right?
Yeah, but in the first book, he had her build a card game about the situation they were in, for mm-hmm. one thing.
Oh, right. I'd forgotten about that. And yeah, and they do talk about, you know, games are a big part of training and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So everything is very game, like gamification worked, I guess, in this right. universe.
So at the Star Trek poker game, you know, does Riker basically pull formation instinct on the other people and that's why he always wins?
I guess so.
Maybe
I
he's think, cheating.
I think that's I mean, why is that he cheating? Grew the beard.
Yeah. Jidao was, oh, because he didn't, oh yeah, I like that one. He's actually from the alternate universe. He's actually the evil Riker this whole time after that season.
Oh, okay, man, we've got to rush to the interwebs and write our fan fiction now. We'll be back. Okay, we're back now.
Yay.
That was easier than I thought it was going to be.
But yeah, there's a lot of game-like stuff in this universe, and to me that sort of makes it fun. And yeah, I would love to play a game based on this universe. Yeah, I mean, it seems a little bit like Warhammer in some ways.
Yeah, the setting is very Warhammer 40K-esque, which is, you know, one of the things I actually liked about the first book and the second book. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't played it extensively, but it does have that sort of rich background.
Right, and the sort of, you know, imperial mindset and so forth in the caste system. Did we have anything more to say about games?
It's the game of life.
Yes. If you go to college, you could make $30,000 a year.
What would I ever do with that much money?
Yes.
Which I guess in 1980 dollars, it was quite a bit more. But.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so they also had a lot of interesting technology. One thing that I missed was there was this whole thing about, in the first book, there was a whole thing about a television show where people did comedy dueling with each other. But
I slew him with puns.
Not quite that bad, but you know, they had to fight each other with swords made out of forks and stuff like that. And, you know, duct tape and so on. But they had to keep that hidden because they were hiding the fact that actually it wasn't actually,
was it a heretical show?
No, it was, but it was Cheris's favorite show.
Right.
And, Jadao, of course, couldn't admit that he watched it because, you know, that's supposed to be, you know, him, not Cheris. He's supposed to be just possessing her.
Right. That was kind of like the big thing where at the end of the first book, they basically say, you know, Jadao is dead. Cheris has his memories.
Cheris has his memories and decides to take over his quest.
And yeah, and kind of, and so I'd forgotten that for this book. Yeah,
weirdly works in its favor because it seems to be, you know, determinedly keeping that as a twist till the end.
Right. And some people did say they had remembered that from the first book, but they thought, oh, maybe things weren't quite as they seemed at the end of the first book or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe it still works if you remember it, but... But yeah, that was kind of like the big mystery that you see where, like, you know, I thought that it was Jadao the whole time. And right. I was still kind of thinking, what was it? I can't quite remember, but, you know.
I was sort of thinking, oh, I kind of thought that she was in charge at the end, but no, I must be wrong.
Right.
So we've just spoiled the previous book in this spoiler section, but I still feel obscurely guilty.
I feel nothing.
We know
that. Well, that's nothing new, right?
And yet I just sort of giggle on occasion to make people feel better.
Yay. So yeah, there's,
awkward silence.
I think I've got to leave that in.
There's kind of this background. You know, one of the main things that was in the first book that also was kind of in the background, this one too, and some foreground, was the whole fact that this is basically a police state, that, you know, the cholendrical system that generates a lot of the special effects and things that they depend on, like, you know, the space drives for the moth drives or whatever. And
right.
That, you know, they have to have this, you know, the remembrances where people are ritually tortured every once in a while on special occasions and, you know, people, you know, ritual suicides and, like, you know, they have these suicide formations that make special stuff happen. So,
and they have the High Council that casually talks about genocide.
Yeah, keep making new ones. Like, hey, let's add a new one because
Thanksgiving is really like a remembrance of, you know, the slaying of the turkey.
Right. But instead it would be like, now all the family can get together so we could ritually torture everybody. Yay. So,
just like now.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Just kidding, mom and dad.
It's the mass torture and cooking of turkeys.
This is something that the whole society, at least the power structure, depends on. You know, maybe the people that live in the society don't always like it. And so there's a lot of these like uprisings, right? The heretics that they have a whole section of their government to put down are trying to be like, you know, we don't really like these periodic tortures. You know, is this really necessary? Of course it is. Let's add some new ones.
Are you sure? Yes, I'm absolutely sure these are required.
Right. At one point, they decided to wipe out Cheris's people, and they're just like, it's sort of too bad that they're not big or important enough to actually be an important remembrance. We'll just, you know.
Oh, right. We couldn't use it for any actual special effect, you know, but you know, let's kill them to see if we can get Cheris to sort of like
Twitch.
Yeah, basically, is this Charis or is this Jadao? Because they didn't know for sure. And, you know, or maybe if Charis was buried in there, she would like take control because that was kind of her people, or, you know, her, you know, so they're like, okay, she'll take over and force Jadao back under or something.
Right.
Of course, you know, he doesn't even Twitch. And then at the end, it turned out, oh no, she was just playing in the long game.
Right.
And, you know, even the, what's his name, Mikidez was like, you know, you shouldn't do it, but not because, you know, it's not useful, just like it's bad policy to go do genocide. Like, you know, it makes people upset.
It's all right. We left like 5,000.
Yeah. He basically recruited a bunch of them and hired them into his faction, you know, to save them.
Yeah. It's sort of weird Schindler's List type of thing.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, good and kind of unsettlingly, you know, bizarre. And then so there's also this part where they're fighting the Hoffen, right? And the Hoffen have their own calendar, you know, so their tech doesn't quite work. And those are kind of interesting where they're having their kind of calendrical battles where it's like, uh-oh, you know, they can get their effects because they can generate their own terrain. So that felt very StarCraft-like, right?
Like, right.
Yeah. And so that's how a lot of this book kind of felt like, oh, it's like an RTS, right? Where it's like, you know, where it kind of felt like, uh-oh, upgrade your thing so you can produce fox forms or whatever. And like,
right.
You know, produce different troop types and stuff like that. And, you know, produce different, you know, clinical effects for your battles and stuff. So that part felt very StarCraft-like or something, which was kind of amusing.
Yeah. I mean, it was a definite power ladder in terms of technologies, right? And for the first time, it seems like, you know, the Hoffen were a bit farther up on the power ladder than the Hex Circuit, right? So they're not quite sure how to react, or, you know, they feel a little slow to the game.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, Jadao / Charis running things is like, you know, kind of a couple steps ahead of everyone else and, you know, planning for the pivotal move in the battle where it's like, okay, I know this is going to happen. So let's, you know, lay a trap for it to stop their, right, you know, spikes from doing a bunch of damage or whatever.
It's not quite 3D chess. It's more like 4D chess.
And in some ways, it sort of seems a little bit like Dune when you sort of think about it that way, because there's like moves within moves. It seems to me like it was kind of what I wanted Dune to be a little bit.
there were a lot of secondary effects that they were depending on to happen for everything to fall into place.
Right. You know, this person will do this, and then this will happen over here.
Right.
Another book this made me think of was if you took Starship Troopers, the book, not the movie, right, and, you know, pushed
What's
it.
What's the difference?
Let's not get started.
One is moving pictures.
Is that what that was? I find it terrifying.
You know, if you took Starship Troopers, the book, and, you know, pushed it, you know, a couple thousand years into the future, right, you know, technology-wise, right, and the whole military, you know, guarantee citizenship and, you know, that whole hierarchy. To me, that's sort of like where this book ends up, you know, what it may have come from.
Right. Well, it has sort of this military cast. I get the impression that that sort of militaristic outlook isn't present among all of the casts.
Right.
There's, of course, the...
But now there's basically a fight over who actually wants which clinical effects to influence them.
Right. Okay, let's see. We should talk about the servitors, who are sort of the hidden power that's going on this entire time. So in the first book...
Can I be sine x squared?
Sure. So in the first book, Charis makes friends with the servitors, and it turns out that that's been a long-standing habit of hers, and then it's gradually revealed that they all talk to each other. And that pays off real big in this book.
Yes.
All right.
It was a long build.
Where it turns out that was the secret key to the winning move in this particular game.
Right. So I was like, how do you have all these amazing spy networks of people implanted and you've been in the Black Cradle for 400 years and everything? It's like, oh, no, I talked to the slave race that we utilize and I'm friends with them, basically. And, you know, so yeah, it isn't an interesting kind of take on... You know, it's more common these days in books where it's like, you know, how sentient AI, like how are you going to deal with that in a society? And it's like, do they have rights or not? You know, are they really sentient or not? What do people think about them? And do they consciously kind of make them a slave race because they want this, or do they even realize they're sentient? You know,
right.
There was like a quote where someone said, well, people tend to give more thought to the wallpaper than to the servitors. Mm-hmm. There's also the whole form thing where they, I was still a little bit unclear because they mentioned like, oh, there's the spider form and the bird form and the whatever form of the servitors. And you're like, it doesn't mean it actually looks like a fox or a bird, you know, or do they look like, you know, biped humans with, you know, like the masks from that TNG episode on or something, you know, what's going on?
It is bird form.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes. I was concerned that that might be a point of obsession. That's what we call a how big are the cats after yes. After the
our first episode.
After our first episode where we just could not figure out how big a certain race of sentient cats were supposed to be.
Yes, exactly.
They were sentient cat-sized.
Exactly.
So I didn't dwell too much on it. I did dwell a bit on in the first book on it, but it did kind of poke in the back of my head where it's just like, oh, what is it? What is it?
There
like
wasn't enough, you know, mention of them to make it, you know, internally consistent for you.
Exactly. Or maybe there wasn't. I just missed that one line in the book or something. But anyway, they, you know, I guess back to the whole sentience where it's like, you know, yes, they really are sentient and most people don't even notice that they're there, kind of like the nobility and like your servants in the house. You barely even notice that the servants in the corner are cleaning stuff while you're doing your important work. And
right. Like, they were smart enough to leave the ship before it exploded.
Yeah. And they actually, that was a good point because they mentioned that, you know, well, of course we have to leave a few of them behind. So they would notice if all of them were gone, they had to have a couple, but also some of the servitors actually purposely wanted to stay.
Right.
They're like, we are Kel, you know, we're dying with, you know, with the humans because we're part of their faction. You know, they consider themselves part of it, even though the humans wouldn't understand or even consider that to be something that would be real.
Did they ever mention if servitors were like completely mechanical or was there some sort of biological component? I can't remember.
I am unclear. I don't know if it was mentioned or not.
Yeah, they rather carefully didn't describe a lot about the servitors, it seemed to me.
Yeah, other than spider form and bird form or some I just heard a while ago, and I think they had other fox form or whatever, other ones, but I don't know.
Oh, by the way, I should introduce the fourth member of this podcast, Table McTableton.
Table form.
Who is a table form servitor that provides the
anti-gravitational power.
Anti-gravitational power. Yes.
I mean, to be honest, the tables in this book actually had some great powers.
Like, exactly.
Like all the things could like self-repair, like if you scratch the table surface.
Right.
Right. It would just sort of repair itself or, you know, as the cat dropped, you know, hairs on the carpet, the carpet would self clean itself. And
well, cause they were like, I forget what they call, but it was like, you know, variable something, you know, variable space or something like that, where it's like, oh no, we reformed our ship because it's more efficient to be in this form while we're on a long travel or something like that.
And, right. And like the Onden ships were intentionally not as optimized, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Well, and yes, they were very, Baroque kind of in their design and, you know, artistic and as opposed to very functional some of the other
I took it as more natural because it was more of a nature theme.
Okay. So like they were more,
but yes, it was very flourishy apparently with a lot of extra flowers and things right. like that.
So, do we have any favorite scenes that we wanted to talk about?
One of the scenes I enjoyed was fairly early on. There was the music box assassination attempt scene. So General Kirovev was the leader of her swarm and Jadao / Cherish shows up and, you know, basically, you know, Cherish shows up, Jadao shows up, whatever they are. And Kirovev is like, you know, take this person off the bridge. And they said, ha ha, not so fast. I'm the general, remember? And then, you know, she started, you know, falling for formation instinct and was like, oh crap, you know? And so, but still in the back of her mind, she wasn't totally certain, I think. So she was able to kind of, you know, trick herself into trying this assassination out. And she was like, she liked tinkering with mechanical things. So she had like, you know, broken music box and stuff in her recorder. So she like made this tiny little assassination robot out of an old music box and some other parts, but she couldn't really concentrate on it very closely. She had to kind of let the back of her mind do it because like the formation instinct would have like made her kill herself. Or
she's just like, I'm just absently putting together, you know, an assassination drone.
Yeah, she's like just fixing the music box, la 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 la. Oh wait, I'm gonna make it walk around for fun, you know.
Even with, you know, all that sort of background processing and putting it together just out of the side of her eye, right, or eyesight,
then right
she was still like, you know, scratching her leg to distract herself and
right. And when she was going to deploy it in the in the conference room, she was sort of like thinking very consciously, oh no, I have an itch in my boot. I had better open that up and itch it. La, 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 while she's like taking it out.
Well, there's like this one part where she validates what she's doing because this is actually better for her, you know, swarm, right?
Right.
Right.
So that's kind of how she's, you know, she's sort of circumventing.
It's my duty to assassinate.
Right. And because they're a monster, supposedly.
Exactly. And this brings me to my favorite scene, which was shortly thereafter when the response from this assassination attempt is Jadao lecturing her on, you know, not doing the assassination properly on him.
Right.
Just like, no, you got other people killed and, you know, this, you're not going to do that's a. That is bad work. I expected better from you.
That's right. Right. That needle gun is supposed to hold 12 needles, and you only exactly. had 8 in there.
It's like, and if you just let it out in the hall, it would have shot me in the back. But no, you did it with a bunch of their, you know, people that could jump in front of me and take the shots. You know,
I can't even trust you to kill me properly.
Exactly. And wow. I thought that
was a flashback to Mount Char there.
Yeah,
I always knew it was going to be you, but
exactly. And I actually think that. I'd love to sort of re-listen to it again because at the time I was sort of playing it a little bit more seriously, but I think that it was really intended to be a little bit more comic in some ways.
Probably. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it certainly was an interesting dressing down.
Yes, I loved that. So yeah, that was my favorite scene.
Oh, my favorite scene was, what is it, when Brezen ends up on the Onden ship,
mm-hmm.
you yeah, know, for the yeah. first time, and he's kind of like wide-eyed and... You know, just looking at it, because I guess he'd never been on one, right? And
right.
So he's kind of just like wandering around going like, wow, this is so much different than our ships. And
well, with all the vegetation and all the flowers everywhere.
Yeah, and sort of the de-optimized routes, which, you know, it seemed like it kind of like, you know, really bugged him in the back of his head.
He's like, this is not OCD. It's not OCD.
That's right. This isn't internally consistent.
I guess all the kills are OCD. Is that how it works?
More or less.
I think they're all sort of stuck in their...
Well, they're
in their faction and
they're
how
forced to be. Yeah,
it's like it's very strong groupthink.
Well, also it's a little bit like when I wander out of engineering world and, you know, it's just like, no, none of this is efficient. You know, why are they kicking the ball to that side of the field when the other side is just going to kick it back? Look,
this is not a half pound hamburger. It's 2/10 shy of half a pound.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, we haven't really even discussed the long game of the book, right? Where the whole point was. They were going to reset the calendar
right.
and change everything. And so, you know, that's of course bad for most of the factions because a lot of their powers will no longer work.
Well, what they were going to do was not make all calendrical effects mandatory.
Right.
You could sort of pick and choose. I don't know if it was based on, you know, your faction choosing or you yourself.
As you yourself.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, oh my God, individual rights. I don't understand.
And that's going to kill formation instinct because... That means you can choose to disobey an order.
Right. And they're like, well, you know, that's what Crashawks do, right? And that's what they did before, you know, the instinct. And, you know, it's the current calendar is because that, you know, crazy, what's his name, Kujin, who's like, I want to be immortal. So as a side effect, everyone else in the entire universe has to deal with all this like bad stuff. But at least I'm immortal. And like,
this sounds like a good plan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the other thing I thought was interesting was, you know, it wasn't actually even a big part of the book. It was kind of like, and I think the intentional thing was, it was just, is the gender, not fluidity per se, but just sort of like the fact that it wasn't even commented on. It just sort of like, that's just how it was. And no one was like, oh, look, this is, you know, people, you know, were transgendered or whatever. It was just like that your physical gender and your, you know, your identified gender could be different. And right, it wasn't a big deal. And it was just sort of like, well, what? And it was something that people could choose. So like Mikadez, you know, he had, I didn't even get this until I reread it, that it was his sister who they said it'd be convenient if he had a body double. So they, you know, did a gender change on her to make her his brother. And, you know, that was like, oh, whatever.
And I didn't get the impression that was surgical. I think that they just basically used calendrical
They flipped
effects.
A bit inside the computer.
Right, and exactly. Now,
yeah, and that's the thing they didn't really explain, but yeah, they had a process that
on next rendering, you know, refresh, you basically showed up as
right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that also kind of plays into the, you know, the whole Jadao thing where, you know, he's inhabiting the body of someone else, right? And there's like a point where in the book where he's like, well, I haven't had a, you know, a cock in 400 years, you know, what do I care, right? You know, that's probably a good point. You might not miss it after the first 50 or something, but, and you know, and then, you know, the sort of the third part of that triangle there is, you know, this whole parentage, you know, element to the book where, you know, they'll get like a group of people together and they all sort of supply genetic material and they make a child. Which I thought was kind of interesting. Oh, right.
They had these kind of like families that they made, and everyone had multiple mothers and fathers.
Right. And then, you know,
I don't think I caught that. I heard the multiple mothers and fathers, but I sort of assumed it was just a group home situation.
The first book went more into it, I think.
But. Yeah. One of the times it was brought up was that, you know, I can't remember who it was. Those two brothers, they considered each other brothers, but they came from like four or five different parents, right? So it's like, are you really still considered siblings because you may not actually have...
Right.
Yeah, such a culture, I think, would have a very hard-to-translate set of gender modifiers and family modifiers.
Yeah, it was the point where they said, like, well, we'd consider them twins even though they were a year apart because they were, you know, they were brought up together, so they were very close. You know? You know, they actually didn't have any problems having... Yeah, sexual relations with one another either.
That was
a little
interesting.
I had to sit there and like process that for a while, but
yeah. Well, at first, yeah, there was some discussion as to whether or not they were clones and whether that would make it better or worse.
I mean, if you define it strictly based on how much genetic material you share, then maybe having sex with your own clone is worse. I'm not.
Yeah, we really don't need to go completely into that right now.
Let me go get my clone out of the closet.
Yes.
Oh, we've been dealing with Barry Alternate today.
Bearded Barry's in the back.
Barry Tertiary.
So yes.
Very, very fun.
For people who enjoy this series, there are also two short stories available. I think they're both available online for free if you want to. They're sort of precursors to the books, but, you know, in temporal mode.
Exactly.
In temporal or in?
Yes,
temporal.
Yeah, oh, which brings us through. There was a brief mention of heretical calendrical erotica.
Yes, that the Mikadez, you know, the one of the leaders still wasn't even allowed to see. He thought, is there's, you know, a rumor that exists in the library somewhere. And you're thinking, what, you know, what are the exotic effects, quote unquote, of this?
It's just like, and then I'm wearing a watch which has a 13 on it.
It's like that time we left that Playboy in the public library.
All right.
Like, actually, now that you mention it, when she was building the assassin drone, right, she was one of the few people who actually had all the spare parts from like old watches and stuff like that, which were, I guess they wore watches as jewelry, but they didn't actually have movements in them.
Otherwise, they'd be heretical.
They'd be heretical, right?
So, right.
That's kind of, maybe that's where, you know, I kind of got that calendrical is the same as time. But
that is the same as time. Yeah, I mean, no, you're not wrong on that.
No, but it's at like a different, it's not a different meta level, but it's a different division level or something. Right. I don't know what to call that. But
it's like the social aspect of time in some ways rather than the sort of aspect, the actual aspect, whatever. I don't know. I'm not going to figure out time right now. Okay. So for the usual questions, was there tea? Yes. And they get special points for, there was one scene when, and that should have been actually my favorite scene. This is my second favorite scene where they're talking, two of the sort of high ritual clan are talking about, talking and, you know, carefully pouring tea with following this particular ritual and, you know, ended with, sometimes I just want to drink the goddamn tea.
All right. There doesn't have to be a ritual around every time we have tea.
Right. So they had lots of different loose leaf teas and different varieties and stuff like that. And it wasn't just, added flavoring. You got the impression they actually were different, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't exactly tea porn, but they did definitely discuss it a lot.
Does it satisfy the tea rage component?
It gets a bonus point for that. It really didn't need a bonus point, but it gets a bonus point. I think the proper thing to do is, which faction would we be in? And I'm going to, you know, we can go briefly through the different factions. There's Shuos, assassins, spies, bureaucrats, Vidona, torturers, wars and enforced laws, kill, formation instincts, and slash soldiers, Haffen. I apologize if I've said Heffen at some point. That's a completely different alien race in a book by Judith Moffat, who used to teach me science fiction back in college.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the Haffen were actually factions, or maybe they used to be. I was a little unclear about that.
Andan, who are the seducers, and they control culture. The Narai, who do math and science, the Rahal make the rules, and the Servitors, who are the robots that secretly do everything. So, Barry, who would you be? I have a personal guess.
Well, I mean, normally we do individual characters. So yeah, I was thinking that you guys, too. You guys usually would suggest that I'd probably be Jadal.
Yeah, I'm assuming you'd be Jadal.
You know. Yes. Well, I was going to assume that you would in Shuos.
Shuos, you know.
Well, he started out Shuos and then wound up Kel, apparently.
Yeah.
Well, in the Kel arsenal, anyway.
There's also a strong, you know, argument for the Vedona.
Enforcing the laws in a special way.
I meant more on the torture part.
Yeah, yes. That's the way to enforce it. Yeah, I don't know. The default for me would be to say I'm, you know, the Narai math and science guy. I don't know. It would be fun to be Jadal though, in kind of a twisted way. I kind of felt myself rooting for Jadal most of the book, even though everyone was like, he's such a monster. I'm like, not really. He's just trying to, like, you know,
he's exactly what they wanted and what they needed for specific things. And they got him out knowing exactly what he would do.
It's one of those relative monstrosity scales. I mean, you know, he's responsible for, I don't know, thousands, millions of deaths, but that is just sort of like a Tuesday in that particular culture.
Right. And also in the first book, I think they revealed why he did it, and there was a reason, but I can't remember now why, but it seemed like it was a good idea at the time.
A surprise reveal in the third book.
I mean, you know, the real monster is Kujan, who was like, you know, the genius that also did all this stuff, and he was also immortal, and he invented the black cradle and everything. So he's like the real monster in the book.
Yeah. I mean, he's a monster. You know, Jadal's a monster, but he's our monster, right?
He's like the monster on a leash or something. But he's also kind of, he's kind of like the revolutionary, right? Like, it seems like the long game is their change in the calendar to kind of free up people. At least that's what he wanted to do. And,
right.
Yeah. To the point where they intentionally seek out people with his qualities and actively get rid of them when they're in school.
Right.
Like that Nine Fox, the Nine Fox.
I thought that was another thing that felt very like a game or a card game where it's like, oh, if you display this thing, you know, they basically have like a special reader. They go, okay, what are you displaying? Are you a Nine Fox? Are you a this or that? And it's like, oh, they're displaying, and you know, it was something like a Nine Fox.
But they could somehow change somebody's signifier or something like that.
Some people could change their signifier. So like they were good spies.
Edited.
So that's what I mean. It felt very like a computer or a card game where it's like, oh, if you turn the card upside down when you're in your, like, you know, hidden signifier mode or something like that.
The transmogrifier card allows me to tap this other card to turn them into a Nine Fox.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And then he therefore completely wipes out your army.
Now, did they much actually describe people, what they looked like? It always seemed to me like
a little bit, but not, I mean, only when it came up with, like, they said like Brezen was a quote female form, but he identified male. And so he was very pleased when Jadal was kind of like, I can't quite figure out if you're male or female. I'm like, felt a little uncomfortable because he's sort of old fashioned, 400 years old or something. Or, I don't know. So yeah, it was, I don't know.
Yeah. I suspect, you know, if I were to choose a cast, I would choose the Servitors. Because they're actually secretly behind the scenes running everything.
They also seem like the most like non-psychotic of anybody. They're just like, we just kind of get stuff done. You know, we do kind of the right thing without being forced to. And
exactly.
We do the right thing until we don't. They're actually the most psychotic. They don't actually speak anymore. And
well, they're the ones that did essentially like cause the, because the whole other behind the scenes thing was when Mikadez basically is like, you know, he murders all the other Hexarchs because he's going to kind of go along with Jadal because he sees that she's going to win.
Right.
And she got, you know, a lot of stuff to happen by getting the Servitors to do it. He just had his brother, you know, basically destroy the entire thing with his ship, you know, because, oh, why would you commit suicide? Huh, it's not me, it's my stand-in. Like, and they volunteered, so hey. He was very upset.
It doesn't pay to be the stunt man in this book.
Yeah. He was very upset, but he volunteered for it.
Yes. Okay, I believe it's time to activate the calendrical terrain and spike the Hugos. So if you'd like to contact us, please contact us at Twitter at SF3 Podcast, Gmail at SF3Podcast@gmail.com, and Apple Podcasts at sci-fi, 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 all one word. So until next time, we have been sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi.